I can't think of another public figure recently where they were like so set up to succeed. People were really rooting for her. They really wanted her to make it. You know, Forbes was so quick to put her on the cover. Like Walgreens didn't ask questions. Forbes didn't ask questions. Nobody asked questions. And I think part of it was like our hunger for a female to succeed in this industry. Hey, this is Have You Heard About, a pop culture podcast that does a deep dive on what we're currently obsessing over. Today's episode is all about disgraced former star of Silicon Valley, Elizabeth Holmes, the rise and fall of her company Theranos, her recent trial, and that mixed bag of a verdict, plus what we think this means for the future of Silicon Valley. I'm your host, Massa. Joining us all the way from Dundee is pop culture journalist and critic Kaylee Donaldson. We're giving away a few copies of the book Bad Blood by investigative journalist John Carreyrou, who broke the story wide open. So be sure to follow our Instagram to learn how you can get a copy at Have You Heard Podcast. If you like the show, please show your support by giving us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and writing a review. It's always much appreciated. So thank you, first of all, so much for joining the podcast today. You are a pop culture writer and critic. You've written for Pajiba for quite a long time.
It's pronounced Pajiba.
Oh, Pajiba. Okay. And can I ask, what does that, does that mean something?
It is basically a made up word that kind of sounds like vagina. And I'm pretty sure that's why the website is called that.
Oh, okay. You know what? I feel like I've always wondered that. And I've always been like, Pajiba. It's obviously someone's last name or it's an inside joke. And I never would have gone from Pajiba to vagina. So thank you for clarifying that.
When I started working for the website, because obviously I work online, I don't really talk to colleagues. Like we talk on Slack, but you don't have to worry about phonetics. And then I mentioned like, it kind of came up in conversation where my colleague says, imagine you've got a cold and you're trying to say vagina. And that's how you say it. And it was like, oh, I've learned something new about my colleagues today.
And do you know, you came up in my last podcast that I did because the topic was Caroline Calloway. So I don't know if you listened to that, but you actually came up in our conversation. And so can I just ask you, can I just go there for a second when Caroline, because we sort of talked about how you broke her like creativity workshop scam, like you were like tweeting all about it. And so that's how people sort of found out about it. And then she ended up making these t-shirts. They said like, what did they say? Like, stop hate following me, Kaylee. Is that what they said?
Yeah. So that happened like the day after or the day, I think the first or second day after the whole thing blew up, I think that happened, if I remember correctly, which was 3 years ago this month also. So
yeah. Yeah. What was that like when those t-shirts were made and you found out about that? Were you like wearing that as a badge of honor or were you like this chick?
At the time, so not to get too deep into some things, but like at that year, that like leading up to that year, I had a really bad mental health break. And that was like, it started leading down that path. I was already kind of on it when the workshop thing happened. But like in the space of a week, my Twitter following doubled in the space of 24 hours and had all these national headlines mentioning my name and talking about this thread. And then it kind of was positioned as this like bitchy war between like the mean blogger and like the nice influencer, which is one of the reasons I kind of pulled away from it really quickly. But when the t-shirt thing happened, I have a really distinct memory. I woke up and my phone, I had literally dozens of direct messages from people, messages on Facebook, emails and stuff from people asking me, have you seen it? And I was in a group chat with some friends who kind of knew who she was as well. And we were kind of like, oh my God, what's going on here? And they were like, okay, someone needs to be awake for when Kaylee finds out. That was the message I saw. Because obviously I'm in a big different time zone from different most people. And I saw it and I kind of just was like, okay. And by this point, I was already getting like threats and weird harassing emails and stuff from some of her fans. Like it was there was a bombardment I was already dealing with. The t-shirt ended up getting pulled quite quickly. Because it broke Threadless's harassment rules. She then tried to claim to, I think it was Refinery 29, that, oh no, I pulled that voluntarily. She didn't. I had to correct the journalist myself on that front. But that whole week, like, there's parts of that week that are just a blur. Because when I started the thread, I'd started it months before the thing happened, because it was just like, hey, this is a person I occasionally follow because she's the worst. And she's like, you know, the thing I check on Facebook when I've got 5 minutes on the toilet or whatever. I didn't expect anyone to be that interested. I think what happened was Firefest exploded around the same time and Anna Delvey was in the news a lot. And I think it was just this timing of the concept of the scam was the millennial scam, I think, was kind of how it's been kind of described, coupled with this deliberately very low stakes, very obviously silly kind of thing. And I think that's what caused it to blow up. There was a period where people just constantly emailed me about her. Not so much, like, I barely get anyone talking about her with me now. Like, I think that's also a sign of how much she's kind of dropped off. But it was a very weird time, yeah. I don't know what you guys discussed in the podcast, but, like, it was very... It's hard to describe. It was surreal.
Yeah, I bet. And we've covered Anna Delvey on this podcast. That was actually our first episode. Caroline Calloway was the latest one. And today we're talking about Elizabeth Holmes. So I guess that we have a thing for covering like scammers in pop culture, although they are all very different types of scammers. They are scammers. Nonetheless, this Elizabeth Holmes story has been going on forever. So I want to, there's so much very detailed information about her story, about the rise and fall of Theranos. And so I think we can just give like a Cliff's Notes summary, just because I think that people have maybe forgotten or it's been so fragmented and there's just been so much stuff about her out there. I think we can just give a Cliff's Notes summary, but I do want to say for the people that are listening that really do want to do their own deep dive on sort of what happened up until her trial, the book Bad Blood by John Carreyrou, who is the investigative journalist who broke the story, is like a must read. We're actually going to give a couple copies of that away via Instagram after this podcast airs. And then there's the corresponding Bad Blood podcast. There's the Dropout podcast. And then there's an HBO documentary called The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley. And she's become like a total pop culture fixture. There are two movies coming out about her. Amanda Seyfried plays her in one. Seyfried, I never know how to pronounce that. And then Jennifer Lawrence, who's in everything, plays her in the other one. So she is like everywhere. At this point, if people don't know who she is and like they don't know like all the details of it, they've at least heard of her. And I have to ask, I have some friends who work in the tech sector, and their opinion of Elizabeth has sort of changed from when the story first broke in the Wall Street Journal and those articles started coming out till today. Has your opinion though, because you've covered Elizabeth for Pajiba, I'm trying to remind myself of like vagina. You've written about her a couple of times. Has your opinion changed of her at all during the course of sort of all of this stuff breaking and then going through the trial and everything? Or have you sort of stayed the course and feeling like, yeah, she's a scammer?
Yeah, I almost feel like scammer is kind of too glib to describe what she is. She's a fraud. You know, I mean, what she was found guilty of as well. And this is the thing, the fact that she was found guilty is kind of a miracle because white collar crime in America is very like, oh, you'll get slapped on the wrist and a fine you can easily pay, and then you'll probably be able to go off and start your next quote-unquote innovation. I mean, the thing about Elizabeth Holmes was that she was very much borrowing from a beloved and kind of well-worn playbook, the Silicon Valley kind of icon. I mean, you know, the turtlenecks and the Steve Jobs cosplay and the buzzwords that are straight out of like Elon Musk's mouth and, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, but like less alien, but still that idea of being almost like this unapproachable genius is what they were playing around with. Certainly what Holmes was playing around with, but playing on the idea that she was the quote unquote only woman. I think that's another reason that, of course, she, you know, gender obviously plays into this because it was that image of the very young, very pretty, blonde, dry-haired blonde. That's a whole other thing we can get into because it is relevant. Yeah. But you know, the girl in the boys club basically, and who was surrounded by men, like all of the people on her board at Theranos were men. So when you have someone who is deliberately playing around with that image to kind of bring in money and bring in attention and clout, and then when it backfires obviously as it did, because once again this was fraud they were committing on a massive and dangerous scale, to call it a scam really isn't enough. And I think that you see this with some of the other players we've kind of talked about. Your Anna Delvey, I think, is the big example. You know, there are people who love Anna Delvey. Maybe it's an ironic kind of stanning, or there's just a sense of like romanticizing the Robin Hood-esque aspect of her, the stealing from the rich to give to yourself kind of thing. You know, it's not heroic and it's a very rose-tinted view of what actually happened. But the idea of, like, screwing over a rich person for fun is very relatable, I think, to some people. And even with, like, Firefest, you know, I don't think people were rooting for Ja Rule and that bro that was in charge of it, but I think that they were laughing at this image of, like, the poor, rich trust fund babies getting their money taken off of them. You don't see that with Elizabeth Holmes, because what she was doing was basically, you know, screwing with people's medical records. You can't romanticize that. It's not like, oh, the app isn't working, or, oh, we didn't book enough caterers for the day or whatever. Like, what she was doing was potentially putting lives on the line. And I don't think you can really spin that as a even ironic kind of tale. So my feeling in her has always just been she knows what she's doing. And I don't find that sympathetic or even especially empathetic. I think you see that now. Sorry to ramble, but, you know, you've seen that in the way that people are talking about, oh, but, you know, I think even her defense rested on this idea that she was the lone woman in the room and it must have been oh so tough for her. And it's like, okay, she's not our ally. Let's not pull the, you know, the lean in on aspect on this, honey. She's not with us.
No. And I feel like, so in doing sort of all this background research on Elizabeth, I feel like she always wanted to be something. Like, she always wanted to be someone. And so this was, as you said, she had this really carefully crafted Steve Jobs persona, like Steve Jobs cosplay she was doing. And I was actually really annoyed when I was reading all this background stuff on her. And they described her in her childhood as being like so precocious. And she had said that she wants to be a billionaire when she grows up. And she says that she wants to be president. And there was a lot of fuss over, I guess she had drawn like a sketch of a time machine. And it was like, and even back then she was, you know, doodling in being like an entrepreneur. Like, honestly, like, have these people met children? Because, like, every kid is like, I want to be, you know, like, every kid is like drawing, you know. So I feel like, and then all this stuff about her taking like Mandarin lessons as a child on the side, and she was developing like C++, I don't know what they're called because I'm not computery. I want to say processors or something that she was selling to people. And then regarding the Steve Jobs sort of mimicking that she was doing, she was like, yeah, you know what? I really admire Steve Jobs, of course. But to be fair, I've been wearing black turtlenecks since I was 7. It's like, have you really been wearing black turtlenecks since you were 7? Like, I don't buy that. And I feel like from like an early age, maybe, and this is just me speculating, I feel like she wanted to be something though. And so she was kind of developing this persona very, very early on. And of course, there's like that deep baritone that she has in her voice. And what I find so comical about her baritone is like, no one can confirm or deny, like, none of her old classmates have stood up to be like, actually, she doesn't actually sound like that. No one has said anything about it except for like, oh, well, there's variations. So I find that so interesting that we're not actually able to get like a real handle of what she was like before her carefully curated Elizabeth Holmes persona became public.
Yeah, I mean, you see that from before John Carreyrou wrote all of his damning articles in the Wall Street Journal. Like, every profile of her is spinning this kind of almost fable of the precocious young genius who had to break the rules to reinvent the world and trying to omit like the actual reality of what was going on. Like, the fact that she's a dropout from Stanford and that was like her big selling point was like, I didn't have to wait for my education. I wanted to get to work. I mean, congratulations on having the money to go to Stanford for a couple semesters and then drop out and not have to worry about your, you know, searing, crippling student debt like most people on the planet. I mean, obviously the very upper middle class nature of her background is kind of skipped over because we love to believe the idea of the self-made billionaire. Like, the way that people still spin that shit about Elon Musk, like, honey, the emerald mining of his South African father, that's where the money came from. You know, Steve Jobs coming from some money, Bill Gates getting like £1 million loan when he was younger. So it is part of the kind of the renegade narrative that you see with a lot of these Silicon Valley brokers, whether they are inventing an app to bring socks to your house, or in this case, trying to essentially what she called democratize the medical industry, which frankly was a very alluring notion at the time. And, you know, wouldn't you buy that and be really excited to buy that if you were American and you had to deal with the American healthcare system? you know, my mom gets blood tests all the time for various conditions she has. And I couldn't imagine what it'd be like having to pay for that constantly. So the idea that, you know what, pop into your local pharmacy or your Walgreens, I think it was in America, two pricks of blood in your finger and it does that. That's a great idea. But, you know, when you read those pieces, like I think Forbes had, I think, the most famous fawning piece about her. It's staggering how much the myth of her as this kind of, you know, young genius is completely smothering and just leading to outright omission of basic facts about science. I think that's what's baffling to me, because a friend of mine, she has a literal PhD in chemistry. She's an actual doctor in chemistry. And I remember talking about this with her, I think around the time that the Fahrenheit started to crumble. I was like, well, they try and take your blood test, your pricks, and your finger. And immediately she went, you can't do that. And she went into this very quick but very detailed explanation as to how that doesn't happen. And it was like, didn't no one in any of these interviews care enough to actually double check basic scientific facts? But was it not glamorous enough, I think? Because I wouldn't say that Holmes was glamorous. She definitely tried to be anti-glamour. But like the story was so glittery that it was, I think it must have blinded so many of these people who want to buy it.
Absolutely. And let's just talk about the story really briefly for the people who don't know as much about it and just sort of piece it together. So like you said, she was going to Stanford, which is like an amazing school in the US. She ends up dropping out after a couple of semesters and she has like a really strong entrepreneurial streak. I'll give her that. So she took a risk. She drops out of school. She finds a company that at the time was called Real Time Cures, later calls it Theranos. And she like literally took one class in microfluidics and was like, I can do like all these inventions. So she came up with the little finger prick idea where you just prick your finger like you would on like a diabetes, like a machine. And with just a couple drops of blood, you would be able to run all these tests. And so it would, her goal was to democratize healthcare. She runs it by her professor at Stanford, who is like an actual chemist and knows a lot about this. And she's like, nice idea, but actually theoretically and technically it's not possible. She presses on and she ends up going to the dean of Stanford, Channing Robertson, pitches it to him. And he's like, this is amazing. And he becomes the first board member. But this is really where her idea could have died. He could have had the same reaction as her professor and said, like, actually, this isn't going to work. But he didn't. He not only believed in it and believed in her, he ended up introducing her to a bunch of really powerful VCs that kind of backed her and gave her a whole bunch of cachet. And we're a big part of the reason that people bought into this, right? She rebrands the company as Theranos in 2003. The blood droplet device is named the Edison, which is like ironic in itself because people that know the background of Edison, he sort of went down the same path where he was like, I've developed like the incandescent light bulb, and he hadn't. But at the end of the day, like in the nick of time, he did. So I thought that was really ironic. And so she claims that all these tests can be done via just like this little droplet of blood. I think it's really interesting what it says about her power of persuasion, because it sounds like the dean and then later the VP, the board members like George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, like there was no lack of power on that board. They so easily bought into her. She's a really compelling person. Is that why people bought into this without doing any sort of like due diligence on like, hey, tell me, great idea. Tell me about how it actually worked.
I mean, she must have been immensely charismatic. And you read that in a lot of interviews and profiles of her. Even I think in John Carreyrou's book, he talks about the fact that she could win over all of these, to put it bluntly, a lot of these older men who really believed in this idea of like this bright young woman who can, you know, storm forward and lead a new path in this very kind of cloistered field, very monopolized field as well. Like that was the other big selling point, was like, let's break up this industry a little bit with some real competition. The fact that we have to have competition in the medical industry is a whole other problem. I think this also, I mean, to bring gender into again, because we kind of have to, like, Mark Zuckerberg is not charismatic. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is a like gray hole of just like personality and ineptitude and cruelty. So I think if she had been like that, it probably, the stories I think would have played out a little differently, because there was this idea of her being a savant kind of in the way that Steve Jobs was, because you hear these stories about Jobs as well. He could be furious and kind of, you know, almighty in his anger, but if you were in his circle, it was hypnotic, it was magnetic. I always found that aspect of Holmes really fascinating because I never got it. And granted, I was only kind of coming through her through written profiles, video interviews, that kind of thing. And I could never get past the aesthetic. Like, I couldn't get past Steve Jobs cosplay. I couldn't get past the clearly very achingly organized attempt to look like, oh, I just tossed this on in the morning, which comes down to things like, obviously, the black turtlenecks, the hair. And you notice this difference because the moment she started like getting kicked out of Theranos and having to go on trial, her hair got a lot better. Like, she was doing some conditioner in her hair because the whole idea that, oh, it's just very dry and like, oh, I'm too important and smart to care about these things. And you obviously, I get it from the point of view of how women in that industry are kind of seen. Like, Marissa Meyer, who was CEO of Yahoo for a couple of years, I remember she did a Vogue photo shoot and it was mocked widely for like, why are you trying to glam up this kind of side of your job? Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook has been doing that for a while. I get it's kind of an unwinnable situation. And it is that thing where you kind of don't want to talk about it because it's like, am I feeding the misogynistic idea of this by talking about it? She kind of like, I've been thinking about her a lot because every time I see Kyrsten Sinema, the Arizona senator in the news, where with her pink wigs and her like, you know, Alice in Wonderland Tea Party style fashion, it's like she's putting on a costume to try and draw attention to it so she can claim it's a distraction when people are criticizing her. And I think that was kind of what Holmes is doing. And that was one of the things I could never get over with her. That and just like the basic science of it. Like, I didn't look too deep into it at the time. It just seems, it's like the cool idea. But maybe this was my shallowness finally paying off in a deep way. All I could think was, do we need another Steve Jobs? Does anyone wear black turtlenecks that well, except for like Audrey Hepburn and Funny Face?
Yeah, I agree with you. And what I find so interesting about this is that everybody talks about how charismatic she was, how compelling, how she was able to convince all these really powerful people to give her hundreds of millions of dollars and defend her over and over and over again. But yet when I see her doing interviews, like pre all of this coming out, I'm like, how is she, like, she comes across, honestly, a little bit, like, it's just put on. I didn't buy into like, that's what she was like. It comes across really like, this is what I'm trying to project onto people. Like, I'm trying to be sort of a big wig. And it just doesn't seem authentic to me. And people have said, journalists who interviewed her actually said that when she was talking about literally anything else besides Theranos, she would actually come across a lot more human. And then the second her company came up and she had to talk about Theranos, it was like a switch would turn on and she would get a lot more serious about it. So nonetheless, she was very successful in convincing all of these people. She may not have convinced me and you, but hey, we don't have hundreds of millions of dollars to give to her cause anyway. So she had raised, by 2010, she'd raised $92 million in funds. And she has all these really important people on her board that I mentioned, including like Betsy DeVos. Her investors included Rupert Murdoch, the Walton family who own Walmart, the DeVos family. And I think it's interesting to note that her big investors were not like your typical Silicon Valley, like VC firms or people in that industry that would be able to ask questions about how the Edison device actually works, the technical side of it, but it was like private family money. And I think it says something about the lack of accountability, the lack of checks and balances that you may get if she had had more tech investors. And I think this is, and I think maybe that was part of the problem. Like when we look at like, how did this go on for so long, many years, and nobody caught it? I feel like this is a big part of the reason why.
Yeah, I mean, this is the crux of what she wanted to do. She wanted to create this dazzling medical company, but she wanted to run it like it was a Silicon Valley app center. And you just can't do that with a company where you're playing around with literally people's blood. You know, you're asking people to donate, you know, mm-hmm. samples of their own DNA that you're then going to do God knows what with because the machines didn't work. So you see that in some, I think the New Yorker was one where they did profile her pre-fall and they did mention that there wasn't any real scientific kind of scrutiny given towards it, or they haven't opened themselves up to it. And the excuse they used was, well, we want to protect the technology. And once again, you can get away with that if mm-hmm. you're like making one of those ugly Tesla cars. You can't do that when you're asking people, you know, to put their medical histories on the line. But they got away with it for so long because I think they built up that hype in such an effective way. The board of all their, like, you know, Henry Kissinger, of all people, like, what does he know about biomedical, you know, science? Clearly nothing. None of them did. Least of all, Elizabeth Holmes and her business partner / boyfriend, Sonny Balwani. And I'd love to get into that because that is fascinating. There was a scientist whose name is, John Ioannidis, who was a Stanford professor. Like, he wrote in 2015, there's no peer-reviewed research on Theranos. They haven't put forward anything like that. And, you know, there were other scientists and, professors saying, at best, they are exaggerating what they claim, because we know how blood tests work. There's a reason your blood test has to come out of your arm. There's a reason it can't come from your fingers, and there's a reason you need a certain amount of blood. And they've been calling that out. But, you know, when it comes to truth versus PR, like, PR wins. Even when the Wall Street Journal was writing these articles, CNBC, the big money channel, the Wall Street kind of channel where everyone talks about profits and buy sell and all that stuff, like, they had her on to be like, why are people being so mean to you? Is it because they just don't like your genius? You know, even at that time, people were so willing to throw themselves, I think, less for her and more for the idea of her company than anything else, because that's what all they were selling was, an idea, because they had jack shit else to offer.
Yeah, you're right. There was no peer reviews. And the way that they skirted around that was just by saying, well, like, they're a private company, so they don't have to, like, share any of their trade secrets. It was, and you mentioned her ex-partner, as well as the ex-COO, Sonny Balwani, who's going to be on trial, I think, next month. And it was said that the way that him and Elizabeth ruled the company was through, like, a lot of secrecy and fear and just, you know, being very, very private. And I think, like you had mentioned before, that the idea of gathering blood through, like, a little finger prick, as opposed to those really annoying, like, the big needles, and, like, they tie the thing around your arm and it's more of a production. Like, of course people want to buy into this idea. It's exciting. And a lot of these investors were early adopters of, like, Oracle and Hotmail, and they got in really early. And so here's another chance for them to kind of get in early. I think sometimes with the people that have a lot of money, like the Rupert Murdochs of the world, I feel like sometimes it's less about making more money and more about, like, winning. And that's just me speculating, because obviously I'm not in their position, but it has a lot of cachet to get in early on the ground and in something like this. And I also wonder, too, if they were almost afraid to ask Elizabeth questions on the technical side when all this stuff was coming up, because she would, like, be known to freeze people out. And it's like, well, if we want the chance to be part of this and we want the chance to invest, then we better just sort of, like, stay the course, not ask too many questions, believe in sort of our leader, which is really interesting when you think about the hold that she had over these people, where it's like they just feel very lucky to be able to be on board. So, and in 2013, she announces a partnership with Walgreens. By 2014 was, like, that very famous Forbes cover that she was on that proclaimed her as being the youngest self-made billionaire with a valuation of $9 billion, which is really exciting because she was, like, the youngest woman tech founder that was that successful at the time. And actually, I can't even think of anyone who's come close except for maybe Whitney Wolf Herd, who's, like, truly, like, self-made. And she had also successfully lobbied the state of Arizona to allow patients to write their own requisitions for blood work. And they called her, like, magnificent when they were allowing her to do that. Like, it was a lot of praise for her. People were really buying into her. But, like, we all know how it turned out. Like, spoiler alert, the machines didn't work. They were completely inaccurate. We find out later they were, in fact, actually take, like, the needles and, like, tubes of blood when people were going into the Theranos centers and the Walgreens to get it done. So they were like, oh yeah, we have to, for these tests, we have to actually take a proper vial of blood, and they would get poked with a needle anyway. And those blood samples would get run on those, you know, commercial lab test machines, like from Siemens and like the other companies. And so they weren't even using the Edison machines. There's so much dirty stuff about like what they were doing to get around this, where like they would pretend they were using the Edison when investors were in the labs. And then they would like take out those samples, go run them behind the scenes, and then bring them back and pretend that the Edison had run them when they hadn't. So the following year, the company valuation drops to like zero after all this bombshell stuff comes out about her through John Carreyrou's reporting in the Wall Street Journal. But I am really hung up on, I can't think of another public figure recently where they were like so set up to succeed. People were really rooting for her. They really wanted her to make it. You know, Forbes was so quick to put her on the cover. Like Walgreens didn't ask questions. Forbes didn't ask questions. Nobody asked questions. And I think part of it was like our hunger for like a female to succeed in this industry.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is her PR definitely played on that, even if she would try to downplay it herself and be like, oh no, I'm just one of the industry and that kind of thing. And once again, I there was clearly a hunger for this kind of thing in the industry. Frankly, the American healthcare system is a total scam. It may be the biggest scam in the past, 100 years or so. It is something that preys on people not even necessarily getting sick, but the fear of them getting sick. And driving them to absolute ruin, all under the fear, well, it's better this than socialism. You know, that's a whole other conversation. But people were rooting for her because, frankly, this was something that a lot of people needed. You don't necessarily need a Tesla car. You don't necessarily need a new iPhone. But frankly, access to your own medical history, the ability to make your own kind of decisions about your healthcare on that front, I think a lot of people do need that. And I think that's very empowering. But I think that's the reason that this fall was so hard. You can't come back from screwing people over with that. You know, it's not like you can say, oh, we made an oopsie. You systematically lied. You've made, fake labs for Joe Biden to walk around when he was vice president, when the real stuff was happening on machines that you'd bought from Siemens, of all companies, because your own machine was basically just a box that didn't actually do anything. And then the way that her and her very expensive and very litigious legal team and publicity team would go after people, including their own former employees, who actually had some sense of medical knowledge, for pointing out, you can't fake this till you make it. Once again, this is not Uber. This is not Apple, which is what they were running it like. So you have all these stories of Sunny Balwani in particular going after very young employees, people basically coming straight out of university with their chemistry and biology degrees. Hey, let's work for the coolest company in town. And it turns out that, the moment you get there, you realize it's a sham. I think a lot of those people did end up, talking to John Carreyrou and going on the Dropout podcast, which is really interesting. I think her biggest mistake was screwing over Tyler Schultz, who is the grandson of one of her board members. Because the thing about nepotism is sometimes it can be really protective. You don't have to worry about getting screwed over if you've already got like a financial safety net from your family. And I think Tyler Schultz knew that. For people who don't know, he basically got a job at Theranos because his granddad is George Schultz, who's the former US Secretary of State under, I believe, Reagan. And he was on this board member and was a huge devotee of Elizabeth Holmes. Like, was inviting her to family dinners and talking about how close he was to her. Tyler Schultz has an actual degree in biology, got there and basically knew almost immediately something is not right. Tries to leave the company. Sunny Balwani goes after him. The very expensive lawyers try to get him to sign NDAs. His own grandparents, including George Schultz, tried to pressure him into signing those. He's siding not with his own grandkid, but with Elizabeth Holmes. He ends up anonymously having to like contact the government and also John Carreyrou to be like, someone needs to listen because my own family won't listen to me. You know, there was a case where the one person I think who really didn't have all that much to lose actually was there and ended up kind of speaking up. Not to give him all of the credit in this, obviously John Carreyrou's work is so incredible. There were other people involved, other workers, but I think that's a sense of what this kind of power does to you, where you really do think that you can get away with absolutely anything if you throw away enough money at it. Even if you don't actually have the money. I mean, talking about the valuation she got from Forbes, $9 billion? That disappeared to zero because there wasn't any actual money. It's the same thing we've been having this conversation about Kylie Jenner. Like, how much is Kylie Jenner actually worth? She's not a billionaire. This is based on the smoke and mirrors of details presented to Forbes in part by Kris Jenner, but in part based on them just pulling it out of their own backsides. These things are all fake. And I think that's the one good thing that came at Fairness, was just exposing none of this is real.
No, and the valuations of tech industries, like, we could have a whole other conversation about, like, WeWork, for example, and the way that tech industries are valued are insane, and I do not understand it. But poor Tyler Schultz, who I think he was saying his parents had spent $400,000 or $500,000 in legal fees. And, you know, he went to his grandfather, George Schultz, and was sort of like, this is what's happening. And George didn't believe him. He stayed the course. He was such a strong believer in Elizabeth, sort of until the very end when everything started to fall apart. And I agree with you that this industry is one that does need to be disrupted. Like, you know, maybe there is a better way. Maybe it's not possible to run hundreds of blood tests via like a finger prick. Then maybe there's a better way of doing it rather than like a tourniquet and a needle and then put it in a centrifuge. And it, you know, it takes a day and it's very expensive. In Canada, our healthcare is all paid for. So like you can go do whatever and the government is going to pay for it. Is it like that in Dundee as well? What is it like for you guys?
Yeah, we have the evil socialized medicine in the UK as well. In Scotland, the Scottish government is in charge of its own healthcare, but it's still the National Health Service. But, you know, if I need to go get a blood test, I will just book it in and go and get it done and it won't cost me anything. As I mentioned, my mom has various health ailments and she gets blood tests regularly. It's one of those things where I'm forever thankful to have it. Just having friends in America and hearing about debt that they're in just for giving birth or breaking an ankle or things like that. So once again, it is that thing with homes. Yeah, I think if the options were, I don't know how much it is to get a blood test on your health insurance in America. I imagine it's not cheap because none of that stuff is.
Well, I was in New York like the year before COVID, just before it hit, and I had to go to the hospital randomly my first day that I got there. And I was there for maybe like 5 hours. It was no big deal. I was pregnant. And so I like something had happened and I felt like I should go get this checked out. And you know how much the bill was for 5 hours? It was $14,000. And they had done a little bit of blood work on me. They'd given me like an ultrasound. And then I called them because we have insurance, so my insurance was going to pay for it. And they were like, yeah, the bill is $14,000 if your insurance pays. But if you don't have insurance, no worries. You can just pay us like $2,000 or $3,000 out of pocket. And I was like, that doesn't even seem like, shouldn't it just cost what it costs, whether or not insurance pays for it? So I feel like there's definitely, yes, this system needs to be disrupted. Someone needs to come in and do a better job of this. And Elizabeth, like the idea was not a bad idea. And she could have said, this is the idea that I have. Everyone is telling me that technically this isn't going to work, but I want to put together this company, Theranos. I want to take investment money and I want to do some exploratory stuff. And maybe that would have gotten her somewhere eventually. Maybe it wouldn't have been like the Edison and the little finger prick, but maybe she would have made some progress. The problem was from the beginning that she was like adamant, it works. It works. We do hundreds of tests. It works. And so I think that was a big missed opportunity there as well. And it just also shows what like a sociopath she is to be able to like boldface lie to all these people. But as you said, John Carreyrou from the Wall Street Journal ends up getting some tips from her ex-employees, including Tyler Schultz, and sort of whistleblows the whole story. Elizabeth like sicks her, you know, really powerful lawyers on him. She even asked Rupert Murdoch, who owns the Wall Street Journal, to like shut this down. And like to his credit, Murdoch was like, no. And so they printed the story, they carried on with it. And that was sort of the beginning of the end. That story, he ended up publishing several articles and then later Bad Blood came out in 2018. And so she denies everything from like the beginning. She's like, oh no, everything works. Everything is great. And she really stays true to the course. And she famously goes on CNBC's Mad Money and says, this is what happens when you work to change things. First, they think you're crazy and then they fight you. And then all of a sudden, you change the world. And I actually feel like she was maybe even like tricking herself. You know how sometimes liars believe their own lies just because they're like a little bit off kilter and they want to believe it so badly? I wonder if she actually felt like she was doing good. I'm not sure that she actually thinks that she's like this big bad that we sort of think of her. I think she actually thinks like, oh no, like, I was doing a great thing.
I think you have to have that kind of mindset. And once again, I think that's the Silicon Valley mindset, the fake it till you make it aspect, the sense that, you know, it's you against the world, which in and of itself is kind of hilarious. I think that billionaires in particular are the worst, like the most sore winners on the planet. And I think you see that with people like, to start throwing rocks here, like Elon Musk and, you know, all of his devotees and everyone that's getting into NFTs and crypto now, which is just awful. I hate all of it. I hate it. Burn it all to the ground. So with Holmes, I mean, I imagine you have to have that sense of like...
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yes. It's so bad. It's so bad. I mean, honestly, NFTs is this whole other thing because the amount of damage it's environmentally done in such a short time, that and cryptocurrency, like it's how much work of years and years of work in environmental like preservation it has undone is such bullshit. To what it actually, I was trying to describe to someone what it was, and then someone told me, so you know how those companies, you can go and buy a star, like you can buy a star for someone as a gift, like, hey, this star XT4 whatever is yours. That's a piece of paper you own that tells you that. You don't actually own the star. The company that sold it to you has no right to tell you you own the star. Those companies fall out of business, which many of them have. There's nothing to stop someone else from doing the exact same thing. That's not yours. You've just given someone money for the idea that you own a thing. You don't own its copyright. You don't own its trademark, any of these things. And I think that's what NFTs are.
Yeah, and it's kind of coming down to the mainstream. I saw a tweet that Reese Witherspoon had posted the other day about, like, you know, if you're not learning about crypto and NFTs right now, you're being left behind, and it's, you know, you're not being part of the conversation. I'm paraphrasing, but that's what I got out of it. And Reese Witherspoon is a pretty like mainstream actress. She appeals to like the masses. And I feel like if I wasn't me, like if I was less of a critical person, I would be like, oh shit, I'm being left behind. And maybe I would take some savings that I actually need for something and spend it on like an NFT or crypto that I don't know anything about. And so I think it's a really dangerous thing.
Yeah, it is. Robin Williams used to have a joke where he said that cocaine was God's way of telling you have too much money. And I feel like crypto is the new version of that. I kind of want to be like Taylor Swift and exclude myself from that narrative altogether, but it's so fucking all consuming right now that I'm being forced to learn about it. Everything I've learned about crypto has been against my will. You know, it's like Emily in Paris. I can't escape it.
We're in a pandemic. You know what I mean? Let's just forget about the fake trading cards. Like, it's unnecessary right now. And so everything falls apart for Elizabeth Holmes. The SEC comes after her and Sunny Balwani. There was a lot of shady stuff that they did. So it's not just like, you know, giving fake revenue on the company and running tests on commercially available machines and saying that it was ran on the Edison. They lied about having a contract with like the US military. They fudged up patient results quite a lot. It was really impactful for some patients. They were told like they had hepatitis B when they didn't. Someone was told her cancer was returning when it wasn't. Someone was told they were having a miscarriage when they weren't. So there were like some serious ramifications to the people level and to the patient level that came out of this. And so the terms of Holmes' settlement included surrendering voting control of Theranos, returning 18.9 million shares, a ban on holding an officer or director position in a publicly traded company for 10 years, and a $500,000 fine and 10 years, I don't know, depending on what happens with her sentencing. She's still young enough. I think she's like 37 or 38 that she could still have a career in front of her. So we'll sort of see what happens with that. But I wonder, is this a cautionary tale for Silicon Valley? I've had some friends in the tech world say to me, like, look, this is something that might impede innovation because now people are scared because look what happened to Elizabeth Holmes. And to that, I say, like, your point, like, this is not like a food delivery app. This isn't like an Angry Birds app. She was playing fire with people's lives. Like, this is actually health and tech are two different things. And there should be, I think, more regulation around med tech going forward in the future in the States if there isn't already. Like, to me, I don't think this affects Silicon Valley that much because I feel like it was really like a lone case. It was just such an unusual thing. It's not Tesla. It's not making a car that doesn't affect people. Although there's maybe something else to be said about self-driving cars, right? And how that may affect people in the future. But there needs to be checks and balances is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that this sort of pseudo-libertarian idea of the Silicon Valley hustle and the, you know, the idea of like innovation for the sake of innovation. And frankly, what a lot of these people are doing aren't innovation. Like the way that people are freaking out over Elon Musk and Tesla's like underground tunnel idea. And it's like, oh, you want to like redo roads and public transport? We have those. Maybe they could use further investment. I know that, you know, frankly, in America, that would be something a lot of people would support. And you see the way that a lot of this stuff, frankly, I mean, Uber and Lyft exist to bust unions. That's why they exist. It has absolutely nothing to do with innovating the way that we drive or transport. It's to bust unions. And you see that a lot, I think, in Silicon Valley. But when you start getting into this tech industry, people are less forgiving. I don't think it will stop this. What's happened will stop people from trying to pull other things like this. Maybe they'll do it on a smaller scale. I mean, WeWork, I think, is a really good example of that. How do you bring the tech world into sharing a desk with some stranger so you don't have to work from your couch, you know, and then basically turn it into a cult? Like, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, look at the way that people fawn over Elon Musk. Like, that hype is always going to have a place. Granted, Elon Musk is actually, at least, and his team were inventing something. But once again, the hype they're using as a way to crush unionizing workers, to monopolize an industry that frankly works better with competition. It probably would work better with some sort of government option. I'm a big hardcore left winger, so I would say that. But you know, this is the kind of future. Like, eventually, these house of cards start to sort of crumble, or you start to see the rot at the heart of it. Like, Apple has millions and millions of devotees, and it's really hard to find any of them who are willing to talk about the human rights abuses for making those iPhones. Uber is changing the landscape of how we transport, but it's harder to get people to root for the unionizing taxi and cab and bus workers in those cities. I live in a city that doesn't have Uber or Lyft. So, you know, I mean, they've fought really hard to keep it out of Dundee, where I live, for that reason. But the runaway train of this kind of stuff is really hard to slow down, partly because the hype is so large, but also because I think people just are really willing to buy into this idea that there are these geniuses out there and they are going to, like, Ayn Rand-esque change the world on their own, which goes against how most change happens, which is really usually boots on the ground community work, really radical activism against the figures in power. It's not about being the figure in power. And I mean, I'm a big left winger, so I would say this, but Holmes was the one that fell because she aimed so high, and the collateral damage was so undeniable. Like, you can't come back from, oh, maybe this person had cancer, but it turns out they didn't. Oops, that's our fault because we were lying about how our tech works. Maybe I'm curious to see if she will actually sell. I'm curious to see if she will actually serve jail time. I know that her lawyers are already trying to play up the, well, she just had a baby and you can't separate a woman from her baby. And like, I fuck the American prison system. Like, the industrial prison complex for profit is evil to me as anything in Silicon Valley. It shouldn't exist. I really have no skin in that game. I think people are really hungry to see some sort of accountability, though. I think that's one of the reasons people were practically dancing in the streets when Martin Shkreli went to jail, the pharma bro who, like, upped the price of AIDS basically because he could. So it will be a tiny victory, but in the grander scheme of how this ecosystem continues to work, we may not see the next Elizabeth Holmes trying to sell blood tests, but we may see the next Elizabeth Holmes trying to sell, you know, the next Airbnb.
Yeah, I also hope, though, if there is something that has large stakes like this, like people's health on the line, I would like to see more due diligence being done, more questions. Like, let this be a cautionary tale to investors, but also to, like, the companies that people trust, like Walgreens, who for some reason were just like, yeah, come and put your blood machines here. Like, that to me is one of the more bonkers aspect of the story, that, like, they didn't even ask questions. You know, they just wanted to be first. I guess we live in, like, a capitalistic society and everyone wants to be first and they want to make money. So I shouldn't be surprised by that, but I am. Let's talk about the trial. So it kicked off in August of this year, 2021, or last year, I guess now, because we're in the new year. There was a 1-year delay with COVID. And in that time, she was busy. She met Billy Evans, a hotel heir, and had a baby boy with him. And people are like all speculating about whether she did that on purpose to garner sympathy. And who knows? She is of like sort of like childbearing age. She's in her late 30s. So maybe she was like, well, if I'm going to prison, it's now or never. There was a lot of speculation prior to the trial starting about what her defense would be. People thought that she was going to, and they rightly thought she was going to throw Balwani under the bus and sort of use him as a bit of a scapegoat. And they also wondered whether or not she would take the stand, which she did. And by all accounts, from what I've read about the journalists that were there when she was taking the stand, she was actually like she did a pretty good job testifying. She came across human. She came across emotional. A lot of it was her talking about how Sonny Balwani controlled her, how he emotionally abused her, he sexually assaulted her. And she did say that he didn't force her to lie to investors, but that she was sort of under his control. And so that, along with feigning ignorance about her role in the company, saying that, you know what, I'm the CEO and I'm the visionary. I had people working in the lab that were doing the technical job. It was their job to make sure that it was running smoothly and it wasn't communicated to me that it wasn't. That sort of made up the extent of her defense. And then the prosecution, of course, was going after her like, well, look at you here, like falsifying revenue. Here's you doing a demonstration that was like totally not real. Here's you. And they were sort of like listing off all the stuff that we now know happened, them using these commercially available machines, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes the defendant doesn't take the stand. I'm not surprised in this case that she did, just because she is like a really, she convinced like Rupert Murdoch to give her hundreds of millions of dollars. Maybe she could convince a jury too, right?
Yeah, I mean, and it must have worked on some level because of the, I think, 11 charges, she was only found guilty of 4, which was 3 counts of wire fraud and 1 conspiracy to commit wire fraud. She wasn't found guilty on counts of defrauding patients themselves. And I don't know enough about the details of obviously what was going on in that jury to really kind of pick apart the P's and Q's on that one. But this was not a slam dunk trial for the prosecution. I think that's our thing to remember. With white collar cases, prosecutions are really not that common. When it does happen, it tends to be a very big deal. When this case was happening and when she was found guilty, Enron came up a lot in conversations because that was a case of people actually going to jail. They were but one cog in a very large machine and not everyone did. But the fact that Holmes will actually face some sort of consequences, and presumably Balwani is going to have to fight a tough case to prove that he wasn't part of the problem. I mean, even with people maybe not necessarily believing the abuse allegations that Holmes has put forward, they didn't believe that she wasn't part of it. So I'm curious as to how another jury will take on Balwani on that front, because a lot of the evidence against him is incredibly damning. I mean, he's the one sending threatening emails to people, you know? So I think that's one of the reasons people were really kind of amped up to see how this would play out. I mean, you don't really see non-celebrities in like court cases getting this kind of coverage. Frankly, we tend to leave this for, you know, Paris Hilton going to jail and things like that.
Yeah. And Balwani, for his part, denies any sort of abuse against Elizabeth. And I'm sure that the prosecution will take what they learned from her case and try to apply it to Balwani's. But I think at first when I heard the verdict, I was disappointed that she was only found guilty of the charges against the investors and not of the patients, because at the end of the day, yes, people lost a lot of money, like very rich people lost a lot of money, but like they're still rich. But patients, I think they're the real victims in all of this. So I was disappointed by that aspect of it. It was a really mixed bag of results. Like you have some guilty, you have some not guilty, you have some like hung, you know, they were hung on like a couple charges as well that ended up getting dismissed. And they deliberated, I think it was like 50 hours or something I had read. And so I feel like they did really take it seriously. Apparently the members of the jury also didn't know a lot about her going into this. So this was all like fresh to them. Where like we all, you know, when we're watching the OJ Simpson trial back when that was happening, we were like, how could they find him not guilty. And maybe we feel the same way about this jury, but I think that they didn't have, allegedly, they didn't have like the knowledge that we would have had because we had read about the trial and read the book and whatnot. To me, although it's a mixed bag, I think it's still a win because they still convicted her. Like you said, it is not easy to get convicted on white collar crime. And she did get convicted on 4 counts against the investors of wire fraud. And wire fraud just is basically like someone giving someone money in exchange for something else. That's kind of all it means. And so she could go to prison for 20 years per count. I've heard anywhere from like a max of 65 years to 80 years was sort of like what I read. I very unlikely that that's going to happen. Like, I think we all know that's not going to happen. I think the bigger question is she going to serve any time? I think she will. I'm like optimistic. I think she should go to jail. I think though that, you know, the judge is going to maybe factor in the fact that she's a new mother, that she has an infant. I don't know if it was like a sympathy ploy and that's why she ended up having the kid or not. Do I think that should be factored in? No, because then what does that say about all of like the incarcerated fathers or like the incarcerated mothers that are in the system there, but maybe they're people of color. And so no one gives a shit, you know? I don't feel like that should be held into account at all when doing the sentencing. And yeah, she's like a bit of a sociopath. So I'm not sure that, I don't know if she's gonna, if it's really that necessary for her to be part of the kid's life right now.
I mean, it is a thing. You can't help but get kind of conspiratorial about, did she have the kid just to be sympathetic and all these things? But also that kind of sympathy from the jury tends to work for rich white ladies. I mean, the amount of, you know, black mothers and fathers who are in the American prison system for the pettiest of crimes and often for decades at a time. There's a wonderful documentary called Time about a woman who is trying to get her husband out of prison, and he's I think it's a 30 or 40 year jail sentence. It's on Amazon for anyone who's interested. It's a stunning piece of work. It is a thing is like, screw the American prison system, and especially during COVID, because like so many prisoners have basically just been left to rot and die in the system. I'm kind of more interested to see what happens afterwards, because once again, I don't think she's serving 80 years. I think I don't know the system well enough to know how much she will serve, but I think once she comes out, like, does she lay low with the husband who's heir to like a major hotel fortune? Does she just go off and become the, you know, basically a full-time wife and mother, which would probably be the smartest idea? Or does she try to worm her way back into another industry? It doesn't have to be the medical industry, but does she try to go on an apology tour? Does she try to, you know, does she get like the really sad Forbes cover where she's just standing by a door in shadows looking sad, and it's like, you know, the fall of Elizabeth Holmes, and as she climbs back to the top, or this kind of nonsense? Because like, there will always be a story to sell here, and I think that's the other reason people are following this. The story doesn't end. You know, it didn't end when Theranos shut down. It didn't end when she was found guilty. Like, something else will happen. Something, I mean, hopefully other people don't get hurt. Ugh.
Yeah, and the real victims here were the patients, right? And on that note of the patient charges being found not guilty, there was a whole bunch of stuff with it where, like, when the patients took the stand, first of all, not all of them could. It was the ones who didn't use insurance, so they paid for the tests out of pocket. Those are the only ones that were able to testify. And when they were able to testify, it was very technical. Like, my test result was incorrect. It wasn't like, I was told I have hepatitis, but actually I didn't, and this is how it made me feel. So there was some dropping the ball on the patient side. And the government also flubbed something up where they were supposed to get like patient records from the Theranos office, and they didn't do it in time. And by the time they did go to get them, Theranos had destroyed them all, which, like, I don't know, like, why was that okay? Like, I don't understand the US legal system. But what I do know about the US is that, like, America loves a comeback story, you know, like, and Adele V is getting a second act through this TV show that's coming out. There's still a whole lot of people that like love Caroline Calloway. I know it's not the same thing. Elizabeth Holmes is very different from them, but like, they love a comeback story. So I could totally see her coming out of prison, and it's like her second act if she goes to prison in the first place. I don't feel like Elizabeth Holmes is capable of living what we would consider to be a normal life, given what she's showed us so far. where she like cosplays Steve Jobs and then says, oh, but I've been doing, you know, I've been wearing turtlenecks since I was 7. I feel like she was always trying to set herself up for this larger than life persona and larger than life existence. And I feel like she's going to be sitting in prison if she goes, trying to think about like, what do I do when I get out? And that's my guess. But I could totally see it happening. I just can't see her laying low and just being like, all right, I guess I'm just going to like be a housewife now.
In an industry or in a world where Mel Gibson is still being regularly employed, despite being a viciously misogynistic anti-Semite, like the world is Elizabeth Holmes's oyster. They do love a combat. I mean, people have short memories. I think they're more willing to forgive some people than others. But like, this is the thing, like when we have the endless cancel culture conversation, which is actually a much more nuanced conversation that we need to have. But ultimately speaking, what we call cancel culture, this sort of glib concept of basically accountability, barely affects people who have money. And whether or not her money was real, and I don't think it was, like that's the smoke and mirrors of you know, Silicon Valley. But clearly she comes from money. She's married into money. She has the security of money. That will save her more than anything else. Like, she's not going to be destitute if she goes to prison. When she comes out, she's going to be fine. You know, she's not going to have to worry about picking up her pieces. Someone will run to her to do a profile. Someone will be like, I would love to option your rights so that we can do another adaptation. Because I feel like actresses are going to start playing her like men play the Joker. You know, we could, by the time, maybe if she does her prison, we'll be getting the films. But, you know, I am deeply, deeply cynical that she will ever actually understand what she has done as being wrong. I don't want to get into like armchair psychology, but it was really clear from the constant I don't recall that she was giving and, you know, testimonies and things that she was huffing her own secret sauce so strong that I don't think she actually understands why doing so was a bad thing.
No, I think that she feels like John Kiriru is responsible for the world not having democratized healthcare. You know what I mean? I feel like she's putting the blame on everyone but herself. But she's going to be just fine whether she goes to prison or not because of her many levels of privilege. One, having money. She still is connected to a lot of really powerful people. Who knows? Maybe some of them are still in touch with her. Also, she is Caucasian. And let's not forget how being Caucasian, how much leverage that gives you in this world, sadly. So before we go, so first of all, I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It was so nice to chat with you. But we always end this podcast by talking about our current pop culture obsession. Do you have one right now?
I have two that I'll keep short. So the great innovation of my life was at Christmas time, I got a Blu-ray player. Thanks, Mum and Dad. So I now own Criterion Collection DVDs, which I'm very excited about because I consider it part of my like duty as a film critic that I have to own a couple. So I was watching Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, which is Paul Schrader's film about Yukio Mishima. It's one of the best films of the 80s. It looks stunning on the edition. I also got they're on my desk. I got the Blu-ray of Blowout, which is John Travolta's Brian De Palma film. It's like a remake of Blow Up, except it's a sound engineer who hears a murder and tries to figure out what's happened. So cool watching those films. My other one is, if you really like The Dropout and you're kind of looking for an equally juicy podcast, Apple has just started a podcast called Wild Things, Siegfried and Roy. It's going to be released weekly. And it is about the infamous magicians slash animal tamers Siegfried and Roy, their entire rise to fame and the attack which left one of them basically not quite paralyzed, but he was basically mauled by one of his own tigers. And it's an investigation into what actually happened.
I remember that.
Yeah, so I kind of come at them from like, I mostly know them as a joke from The Simpsons because I think they were a very American phenomenon. It's been fascinating to look at the story of these two incredibly like, beyond parody figures who lived the American dream and had this huge show. I think for a while they mentioned in the podcast it was the most successful live entertainment show of all time for a period. Like, it was beating any Broadway show, for instance. They sold out every night for like 2 decades or something in Vegas. And you get the story of this, but you also get the story of the animals. And I think that's the thing that's sad. So if you're looking for something to listen to while you're still stuck in your house with COVID and lockdown, hello, that's me. It's called Wild Things and it's only on Apple.
Okay, good to know. I also have two obsessions. One is Wordle. Have you been wordling? Do you know what this is?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was that thing where I had all these weird grids on my Twitter feed and I was like, okay, I'll do it too. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is actually great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so good. And one day, it was like 2 days in a row, I got the word on the second try. And I sent it to like everybody I know. No one cares, but I think I'm like going to try to ride that high throughout the rest of 22. And the other thing that I'm like so obsessed with that you probably have watched this already because you're a pop culture critic, but is Yellow Jackets.
Oh, yeah. It's so good.
It's so good. It's so good. It's so good that I'm like, I wish I could go back in time to when I hadn't watched it just so I could experience it from the first. And I'm like a scaredy cat. I'm not good with like scary stuff, but this one I like really just pummeled through because I was like, it's so good. I have to know what happens. And it's like Lord of the Flies. It's for anyone that doesn't know Yellow Jackets. It's a show on Crave in Canada, HBO in the States. And it's about a group of girls who get stuck on like a remote Canadian wilderness after their plane crashes. It's very Lord of the Flies, hence like the title Yellow Jackets. But I think teenage girls are far more interesting, to be honest, than teenage boys. So it is so good. It is so good. The adult characters that play them are just as compelling as the teenage versions of them, which is, you know, you don't often get that when you're watching a show or a movie where it's sort of flash forwarding between the past and the present. Usually you're more interested in like one than the other. But for me in this show, I'm equally as interested in both. So check out Yellow Jackets and let's wordle our way through COVID, because I think that's the point that we are at right now.
Yeah. It's so wonderful to have like a genuine kind of like water cooler TV show that's weekly that everyone's kind of really amped up about. I'm so thrilled to see Melanie Lynskey and Christina Ricci getting really great work as well, because I think that they're both so wonderful and unappreciated. And now people are realizing, yeah, oh, yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah.
So it's highly worth it. Like, you can catch up on it pretty quickly. Go for it.
Yes. I'm jealous of anyone who hasn't seen it yet. And once again, Kaylee, I just want to say thank you so much. It was so fun to discuss Elizabeth Holmes with you. We're going to see what happens with her sentencing. It's happening in September. We'll see what happens with Sunny Balwani's trial, which is happening next month. I'm happy she got sentenced, because a lot of times these white collar crimes, they just kind of go by the wayside and no one gets convicted. So at least we got a conviction. And yeah, stay tuned to see what happens. That's our show. Thanks for listening. For your pop culture fix, including what we're currently watching, reading, or generally obsessing over, be sure to follow our Instagram at Have You Heard Podcast. We love engaging with listeners, so feel free to DM us to share your thoughts on the latest podcast or anything and everything pop culture related. Stay tuned for the next episode, where we do a deep dive on the most binge-worthy show we've seen in a long time, the fantastically chilling Yellow Jackets. If you enjoy the show, please share and give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and write a review. It goes a long way with helping the podcast reach more listeners and is greatly appreciated. Until next time.